It is January 13th, 2021, and we are here now on the next matter on our calendar for oral argument is the state of Minnesota versus Ronald John Miller. I am Judge Bjorkman. I am joined on the panel this morning by Judges Diane Bratfold and Jeffrey Bryan. Even though we are connected by Zoom rather than in person, the same rules of oral argument apply. You will each have 15 minutes to present your argument, and it is important at the outset of your argument that you state your name and identify the party you represent. And with that, counsel for appellant, you may proceed.
Thank you. May it please the court. My name is Christina Zahar, and I represent the appellant, Ronald John Miller. In the event of a conflict between a defendant's constitutional rights and the rape shield statutes, a defendant's constitutional rights require admission of evidence that would otherwise be excluded by the rape shield law. This court should reverse appellant's conviction of criminal sexual conduct in the fourth degree because the district court misapplied the rape shield law in violation of appellant's constitutional rights. This abuse of discretion caused the exclusion of exculpatory evidence that would have shown other potential sources of the Y chromosome found on the complainant, and caused the exclusion of evidence that directly contradicted the complainant's statement to police as well as her testimony. The state cannot show beyond a reasonable doubt that the court's error was harmless in this case. Minnesota rape shield laws, which are codified in Minnesota Rule of Evidence 412 and Minnesota Statute 609.347, have the purpose of emphasizing that a sexual assault victim's personal sexual history is generally irrelevant and not admissible in criminal trials. However, case law is extremely clear that the rape shield law is not absolute. The purpose is not to remove relevant evidence from a jury's consideration. As an example, in the Hagen case, this court ruled that where a defendant claimed to have no contact with the complainant, the rape shield was not intended to bar the admission of evidence that negated the charged crime. In that case, it was DNA evidence not belonging to that defendant. The court ruled he should have been able to admit as that acted to negate or exonerate him. Evidence of previous sexual conduct is admissible in all cases in which admission is constitutionally required. And that was the case here. So the excluded DNA evidence in this case was not only relevant, but admission was critical to the appellant's rights to fundamental fairness, to present a complete defense, and to confront witnesses. Most importantly in this case—
Let me ask you this. It seems to me, I understand your argument that the district court evidentiary ruling was an error, but as a practical matter, didn't the jury hear the evidence that you're now complaining was excluded? I mean, the jury in fact learned that the victim had sexual contact with others, that someone else's DNA was in fact found on her body. I mean, what else was excluded that violates your client's constitutional rights?
Thank you, Your Honor. No, I would disagree that the jury did get to hear that evidence. The jury did not hear any evidence that there was other DNA found in the mons pubis swab where the Y chromosome was found. And although there was a point where the BC expert did say that there was a saliva sample found on her breast, that was in contradiction to the court's rape shield order. I was not, it would not have been allowed to ask further questions on that point, nor argue that point in closing arguments. That was an instance where a witness, not fully understanding the court order, blurted out information that was not allowed by the court's order. So I was not—
Was there further discussion? And again, I understand that there's two different items or swabs. We're talking about the saliva, and then we have two subparts to item 1F. But in terms of the saliva and the DNA evidence, was there discussion after, as you're saying, that was blurted out? Was there any discussion after as to what the defense could do with that statement? Was there a motion to strike from the prosecution? Was there any attempt to get permission to work with that statement?
The state did not bring a motion to strike, but the defense, myself, presented a motion to reconsider the rape shield ruling at least 2 to 3 times during the course of the trial. as more evidence came out, and the court did maintain its ruling that that evidence would not be admissible.
So, but counsel, let me just follow up quickly. Sorry, Judge Bryan. I just want to make sure. Are you saying you made a motion to reconsider after the blurt out?
I do believe I did.
Okay, thanks.
I do. We'd have to check the record, but thank you.
Sorry, Judge Bryan. Go ahead.
That's essentially what I was going to ask. I wanted to get a specific instruction or discussion in the record about whether you could use that statement or not. It's one thing for a court to issue a pretrial ruling. It's another to, once something has happened, for an attorney to try and rely on that statement. If it's in the record because the state never moved to strike, then it's in the record and it should be something that the parties would be able to rely on, and the court would have to either strike it or permit it to be used. And I didn't see one way or the other, so I wanted to get more information from you on that point. And again, we're just talking at this time about the saliva DNA, not the item 1F.
That's correct, yes. And based on the rulings I'd made during the trial at various phases, it was very clear to counsel that we were not to discuss any prior sexual conduct of this alleged victim during this trial. And the court is right that we're talking about two different DNA samples. So we have the saliva on the breast, which was found but did not belong to the defendant.
And counsel, just to stop you for a moment, the witness, and I believe that's Mr. Getz, I'm not sure how to say his name, but the BCA scientist, Mr. Getz, he testified about the breast swab, I think. And he's the one that did confirmed that the sample did not include excluded Mr. Miller. Isn't that right? As to the breast swab?
Yes, that is.
And you were allowed to ask that question, get that answer, which is similar to the Hagen case, exactly, right?
I think, Your Honor, that was said. Again, it was one of those moments where it was clear the witness had blurted out information that would have been precluded by the court's order.
So I'm drawing a slight difference here. You know, the question you were allowed to ask, and you did ask without any objection, was whether the breast swab included saliva from the defendant. And
yes,
the witness answered both things. I mean, the witness gave the answer indicating it was someone else's saliva, as well as it is not Mr. Miller's. So you got that evidence in, right?
Yes, Your Honor. But again, I do not believe I would have been able to argue that point.
Argue that, and you did argue in closing that the saliva was not from Mr. Miller. So you did get that evidence in.
Well, I did argue that no saliva of Mr. Miller's was found on her breast, which I
Correct.
Think is a slight distinction from whether it's someone else's.
Oh, I agree. And I'm just trying to say the first half of it, that's all.
Yes, absolutely. That's
okay.
Correct.
All right.
Perhaps even more importantly, I believe, is the Y chromosome evidence that was found in the swab from the mons pubis. The Y chromosome found was the only piece of physical evidence that connected, that the state argued connected.
If I could jump in, Ms. Wahar, because sure. I think that there were, you know, if you look very closely, there's two different parts of that swab. Item 1F has a non-sperm cell fraction and a sperm cell fraction. And in looking at the addendum and the BCA lab report, it looks like there was an exclusion of Mr. Miller as someone who contributed the portion that is that was not subject to the Y chromosomal test, right? So that I think is the non-sperm cell fraction, but it's the same swab. And so my question is, what were you permitted to ask the same question about the non-sperm cell fraction portion of item 1F that you were permitted to ask about the saliva? In other words, could you have asked, and did you ask, whether Mr. Miller was excluded as someone who contributed the non-sperm cell fraction of item 1F?
I was able, about the non-sperm cell fraction, which we're talking about the Y chromosome, I was able to talk about what that means as far as what it means to match someone's Y chromosome, but I was not able to ask questions about whether there was anyone else's DNA found on that swab as
and maybe I misspoke. I'm referring to the portion of item 1F that Miller was excluded from. And I think I referred to that as the non-sperm cell fraction, but maybe I'm misremembering, and it's actually the sperm cell fraction portion that he was excluded from.
That's correct. He was excluded from the sperm cell fraction.
Then let me rephrase with regard to that. I'm sorry, but did you ask whether or not Miller was excluded as a contributor of the sperm cell fraction? And could you have asked, more importantly?
No, I could not have asked that question, because that would have brought up that there was other DNA, male DNA on the victim. So what I was able to ask, again, was just details about what this Y chromosome meant, how it's an exclusionary tool, not necessarily an identifying tool in the sense that a DNA profile is. It's more akin to a blood type. Just because a person has a type A blood type doesn't necessarily mean they're the person who left that type A blood at a crime scene. So I was able to ask those types of questions, but a hypothetical other depositor of a Y chromosome is much, much different than an actual potential depositor of a Y chromosome from another man whose DNA was actually present on her body. And that's the part I was not able to present or argue to the jury, which in this case would have been extremely critical given how important that piece of evidence was to the state's case. The jury wasn't able to hear that there was actually other male DNA on that same spot on her body that could have just as likely been the contributor of that Y chromosome. They were only able to hear that hypothetically, it could have come from another male. They were able to hear that hypothetically, one in 25 approximately men share that same Y chromosome profile, but they were not able to hear that there actually was other male DNA present in that same location. So that is the importance of that piece of evidence that I was not able to present or argue for the jury. In this case, the district court actually did.
I'm sorry, if I could jump in again.
Yes.
You mentioned one in 25, and one of the questions I had was, it looks like there's perhaps a mistake between 4% and 0.04%. The report doesn't say one in 25. It basically says one in 2,500. So what do we look at in terms of deciding whether there was prejudicial error? What do we, or applying the balancing test in either 412 or 403 that requires some determination of prejudice. In applying that balancing test or deciding prejudicial error, are we permitted to look at 0.04% as the fact that was introduced, or are we looking at 4% as I think the testimony stated?
Correct, Your Honor. I believe the court is able to look at both of those pieces of evidence, the testimony as well as the admitted reports that we stipulated to. What's more important here is that we don't know the Y chromosome profile of that other male or other males, plural, who are present on that location. And that is what violated defendants' constitutional rights. It's less about the percentage or the likelihood that that could be, but the fact-
But in terms of the prejudicial impact of allowing it, if there's evidence that Mr. Miller is consistent with the Y chromosome, and there's only 0.04% of the white population that would also be consistent with that. That evidence is something we could look to determine whether or not there was prejudicial error.
That's correct, Your Honor. In addition to the testimony of the expert discussing that evidence, our position for the standard of review here that the state actually needs to show beyond a reasonable doubt that there was no prejudicial error to the defendant in this case as a result of the excluded evidence, since his constitutional rights were implicated. The court in this case actually did find that there was a conflict between the rape shield law and the evidence that the defendant was seeking to admit, in other words, with his constitutional rights, but the court stopped at that point, and instead of doing any sort of balancing test or conducting an analysis as prescribed by the case law, and as told by the case law, when there's a conflict, the constitutional rights are what win. The district court stopped at that point, simply said the evidence would be excluded because of that conflict with the rape shield. And because of that, defendant's hands were tied and he was not able to defend himself in a manner that's consistent with the Constitution. The state cannot show in this case that the error was harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. And for those reasons, I respectfully request that the court reverse appellant's conviction for criminal sexual conduct in the fourth degree.
Thank you, counsel. You will have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you.
And counsel for respondent, you may proceed.
Thank you. Good morning, your honors, counsel. My name is Heather Pippenhagen. I'm an assistant Dakota County attorney, and I'm here on behalf of the respondent in this appeal, which is the state of Minnesota. Your honors, in this case, the district court did not abuse its discretion when it excluded these two pieces of evidence. Neither of these two pieces of evidence that we're discussing today were at all probative to or relevant to the victim's propensity or motive to fabricate these allegations against Mr. Miller, which was the defense in this case. It was fabrication. And this point becomes incredibly clear, your honors, if you simply try to imagine how the defendant could use these two pieces of evidence in an argument to support this defense of fabrication. It just doesn't fit with the defense in this case, which is why it was not probative or relevant. And I'd like to just discuss the two pieces of evidence separately.
Before Ms. Pippenhagen, before you get to those specific pieces of evidence, if we could pause for a minute and look at the legal principles here. My understanding is that you have a constitutional layer, and then you also have the rule, Rule 412. And there are certain circumstances under Rule 412 that this heightened balancing test would apply. But if there's a constitutional conflict, we look to Rule 403 in terms of the balancing test that we apply. The issue of evidence tending to show a predisposition to fabricate, are you saying that the constitutional conflict only relates to evidence of a predisposition to fabricate? In other words, you only apply the 403 balancing test if the defense is seeking to introduce evidence that this victim has previously made false accusations. Is that the only time that the 403 constitutional standard comes into play? And every other time you have to fit one of the two buckets in 412.1?
And let me explain it better. So Rule 412 and Statute 609.347, which are essentially the same, they outline the prohibitions against the admission of this evidence. The Constitution, however, says if this evidence is relevant, despite this prohibition, if it is so relevant in the case and it is more probative than prejudicial, the defense, if they can show that overcomes the statute and the rule, the court can, in its discretion, admit that evidence. And that analysis is going to be on a case-by-case basis. And it's going to be directly related to what the defense is in the case. And we saw that in the Crocius case, in the Hagen case. You're going to have different situations in which the evidence will be relevant for different purposes. In this case, there was no issue of mistaken identity. There was no issue that there would be previous sexual contact that would give the victim a source of sexual knowledge. She was certainly of the age where that was feasible. Really, the only defense in this case was fabrication. So in that case, the court has to analyze the proffered evidence in light of that, its relevance, and then the probative versus prejudicial effect. So I don't think fabrication is the only time the Constitution would overcome that rule and statute. But I think in this case, that was the only argument that was being put forward.
Is there any way for a defendant to deny the allegations without simultaneously raising fabrication?
I think in a case, for example, of mistaken identity, So, you know, had this victim been attacked in a park by a stranger, and then there's this evidence on her body, she picks him out in a lineup, but then we get this DNA and serology evidence that comes back that says, whoa, it wasn't this person's DNA that was on her breast, it was somebody else's, you know, then that would be exculpatory evidence when she didn't know the assailant. And that's not the kind of case we have here. So this case really does just come down to fabrication. Whether or not she has a propensity to fabricate has been argued for relevance.
Let me jump in, because if this third person's DNA was also consistent with the Y chromosome, if that person is one of the one out of 2,500 people, then wouldn't what you just said about it being, of course, exculpatory evidence that would be admissible, wouldn't that be true? And so the gap is really, we don't know. And the difference between what you just admitted would be admissible and what we have in this case is we have a possibility of a match. We just don't know because no one did the test.
Well, and because we don't have this third, you know, I think that kind of cuts against the defense argument too, because we don't have a known sample from this third person. There's no way to say that it would be exculpatory at the same time. We don't have that evidence to rebut or support the argument that semen would have been the source of this Y chromosome. And one thing we do know is this case, the allegations in this case have nothing to do with semen. The only contact with the vaginal area in this case that the victim represented was digital penetration. So semen had absolutely no play. And that goes to why the evidence of the two other sources of semen, one identified, one not identified, were not relevant. There just was no semen that was at issue in this case. And certainly the victim never got on the stand and said, I've never had any sexual contact with anybody else. Had she done that, we'd be in a completely different place. And then that would obviously make that evidence relevant, if nothing else, to impeach her. That was never argued by the state, and the victim never testified that he would be the sole source of that Y chromosome. And the testimony in this case from the BCA expert established that he was not the sole source of this Y chromosome. She in fact said, I can't say that it matches him. She can just say it's consistent. This Y chromosome is consistent, but she can't identify it as his because, as she testified, 4% of the just the Caucasian population would have this same Y chromosome, inclusive of all of his paternal relatives. Now, I mean, there weren't really any paternal relatives at play that we know of in this case, but 4% of just the Caucasian population, that's a significant number for the jury to hear. And they heard that evidence. Going back, just to start with that serology evidence from the swab of the victim's breast area that was excluded, I think it's important to note that what the jury didn't hear was actually quite limited. The jury heard the victim's allegation that Mr. Miller put his mouth on her breast, that she had not showered after he did that morning. Yet the jury heard that his DNA was not found anywhere on the swabs of her breast, and that somebody else's DNA was found on the swabs of her breast. The only thing the jury did not hear in this case is that the DNA that belonged to someone else that was found on her breast came from saliva. That part, the BCA expert did not say it was somebody else's saliva on her breast. If you look at page 319 of the transcript, the question to Mr. Goetz was Mr. Miller's DNA found on the bilateral breast swab in this case? And he said, there was a major DNA profile that did not match Mr. Miller. And the prosecutor then went on. So it wasn't specific that it was saliva, but certainly the point got out there that there was somebody else's DNA on her breast, but much more importantly, that Mr. Miller's DNA was not on her breast, even though she said she hadn't showered. So really what the jury didn't hear as far as evidence in this case was minimal. It was that it was from saliva. So for that reason, and again, this wasn't a case of a mistaken identity situation where, wow, that would be really important to know or to match that to somebody else. She was identifying her perpetrator in this case. Therefore, her credibility was exposed based on her statement that she hadn't showered after, and that he placed his mouth on her breast. So if you look at that whole picture and the evidence that got to the jury, even if this court found it was error and that the jury should have heard that additional piece, that that other person's DNA was in saliva, it would be harmless error beyond a reasonable doubt in light of the fact that the whole argument that her credibility, that she hadn't showered after he put his mouth on her breast, that was there, that was exposed. That was there for the jury to hear, that was there for the defendant to argue. And the other facts in this case just make the case so strong that beyond a reasonable doubt, that would not have affected the verdict. The other facts being the text message evidence between she and her friends, she and Mr. Miller, her immediate report of this incident within moments to others, her demeanor when she was speaking with the investigators, her demeanor when she was speaking with the nurse, and also equally important, the defendant's credibility when he testified in light of the fact that his version of the facts was not consistent necessarily with the timeline established by the text messages. So the jury had
Ms.
all
Pipe
of that.
Hagen, I'd like to ask you about the expert's testimony on the Y chromosome and the presence in 4% of the population. I'm sure you heard Judge Bryan's earlier question that it was the testimony offered by Ms. Anderson, but the report seems to reflect a different percentage in the Caucasian population. I think it's 0.04.
And
so what does this court look at in, for instance, evaluating prejudice beyond a reasonable doubt for the exclusion of this evidence?
Well, I think obviously all evidence can be evaluated. I did not note that difference in the report. But I mean,
so it's in the appellant's addendum. You know, obviously sure. We're in the middle of arguments. So
yeah.
If you at some point want to take a look at it, the chart does say 0.04, and I'm not looking at it exactly now either, but as opposed to 4%, but the witness definitely testified 4%. Everyone seems to agree on that. That's what I see in the transcript.
Yep. She definitely did. And honestly, we can all speculate to what the jury gives weight to. I mean, the jury listened to the expert testify. Do we assume they look at exhibits? We certainly assume they look at exhibits. So I think you can evaluate both of the pieces of evidence. But
well, I don't. The jury didn't actually get the BCA report that's in the addendum, though, right?
That's right. It was a court exhibit. Yeah. Correct. Yes, it was a court exhibit.
So they don't have the information, I don't believe. The jury does not have the information about 0.04. We have it as a court exhibit was the actual. Yeah.
You are correct. It was a court. Now that I think about it, it was a court exhibit. You are correct. And therefore, all the jury heard was the 4%. Correct. And that makes it really significant that one in every 25 Caucasian people she could have had sexual contact with would have had this same Y profile. So just to cover them, that second piece of evidence, again, there was semen from two other people other than the defendant found in two swabs of her vaginal area. There is no allegation of any type of sexual conduct with Mr. Miller in this case that would at all be connected with semen.
Ms. Pipenhagen, if I can jump in, the question that's asked about the saliva, is Mr. Miller excluded as someone who contributed the saliva in this sample? You seem to argue that that question was permissible given the pretrial rulings. Is that correct? Do you think that that was a permissible question, or was that question violation of the ruling?
The statement that somebody else's DNA was found in, or that saliva was found?
You're right to point out a distinction between the question asked and the answer given. And I think you're right to focus on the answer given. So let's start with what you said. The answer given, thank you for correcting me. Do you think that that answer was given and that violated the pretrial rulings, or was that an appropriate answer?
I did not see that as a violation of the pretrial rulings. They certainly...
So I know you don't have much time, so let me just jump to the more important question. If that's not a violation of the pretrial ruling, then wouldn't it have been permissible to ask that same question or to give that same answer as it relates to the Y chromosome, either part of item F, either fraction?
I don't agree with that, because the other evidence was evidence of semen, which was not related to this case.
Well, I know you said that a couple of times, but was there an objection to the state's presentation of semen evidence in this case as itself a violation of 403? Because as you pointed out, if there's no allegation that would relate to semen, then the probative value of presenting semen evidence would be almost nothing. Was there any objection from the defense as to that? Because the state was the proponent of that Y chromosome evidence.
It's not all semen.
Correct. Well, but that evidence was admitted. The court did agree that evidence could be admitted. It was the semen evidence that the court excluded. Maybe I'm confused by the question.
Maybe I'm the one who's confused. I think the question I'm looking at is testimony regarding the Y chromosome evidence. And I see the time has expired. If it's okay to proceed, if not, I'm happy to leave my question alone and we can move on.
You can go ahead with your question, Judge Brian.
Okay. So I'm asking about the Y chromosome evidence that was presented to the jury. And if there is no semen allegation, then as you're saying, there would be very little probative value to the state offering any evidence of item 1F. And it seems a little inconsistent for the state to have offered such evidence on one hand, despite its low probative value, and then to argue that the corollary or the companion argument from the alternative argument from the defense would be excludable because of the low probative value of semen. It seems a little inconsistent to have it both ways.
Now I understand your question. And the answer is the Y chromosome evidence is not exclusive to semen. The Y chromosome could have come from other sources, saliva, touch, other sources of his DNA. The Y chromosome is not exclusive to semen. That's why that evidence was relevant and did not fall within the court's exclusionary order regarding the semen evidence.
Thank you, counsel. Ms. Zahar, you have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you. I think it's really critical to note here that Mr. Miller was actually acquitted of the third degree criminal sexual conduct penetration charge. And I credit that in good amount to the fact that there was no physical evidence indicating penetration, even though the victim clearly testified that penetration had occurred. And this highlights how important that Y chromosome was for the jury, because they took that presumably as evidence of sexual contact, and that is the charge that they convicted him of. For this court's analysis, I believe it most important to evaluate the evidence that the jury actually heard, as opposed to the evidence that was presented as court exhibits for the purposes of this court's analysis and determining prejudice. Finally, the state did argue a point about that the other male contributor was never identified and therefore the probative value is very low. And in regards to that point, the burden is not on the defense to prove or establish innocence. The burden is on the state to prove a defendant's guilt. And it is not the defendant's fault that this other party was never identified or that a sample was not obtained from this other party. That is not something that should be held against the defendant if the state did not have that information. And in fact, the defendant should have been able to argue there is other male DNA present in the same location as this Y chromosome. We don't know who that belongs to or if that person has this same Y chromosome profile. The other point I had noted was that fabrication or credibility of the complainant is just one of our arguments here on the appeal. We also are arguing that this evidence was in fact exculpatory of Mr. Miller.
So let me follow up quickly on that exculpatory argument. And again, here, I think you're referring to the Y chromosome Yes. Evidence, which, as you both discussed, came in two parts. It has the sperm fraction as well as the non-sperm fraction. And when you said that we should not look at the court exhibits to determine a prejudice, I don't think you meant that as far as what the evidence would have been offered. You would have offered the evidence as stated in the court exhibit, right?
Of course, yes.
That's what you wanted. And on that second sample, the non-sperm sample, the evidence that you would have offered, as I read it, it's, so it's A23 of your addendum, is that it was a mixture of two or more male individuals. And then the part that did go to the jury is that one of those individuals is a match to Mr. Miller's DNA profile. And then we go on with all the statistics, right?
Well, the jury did not know it was a mixture.
No, I know. That's the part you want to get in. It's correct. A mixture of two or more.
So right? What the jury heard was that it's a Y chromosome profile that matches Mr. Miller's Y chromosome profile.
I understand. I want to know what you want to get in. You want to get in, it's two or more males.
That's exactly right. Correct.
So even in your best case scenario, the jury would still hear that out of those two or more males, there's a match to Mr. Miller's DNA profile or his Y chromosome, right? Okay. I just want to be clear. I thought that was obvious, but I...
Yes, that is clear. And there is a lot of strength to evidence of that nature, asking the jury to think of a hypothetical situation versus an actual situation.
Right. But I guess my question for you is, it doesn't exculpate Mr. Miller. It simply allows you to argue reasonable doubt, which is a big deal. Don't get me wrong. I appreciate that's a very big deal. But it is not evidence that his Y chromosome DNA profile was not present.
That's correct. It's probably better phrased exculpatory in nature, mm-hmm. Where it's not exculpatory necessarily in and of itself, but it certainly was a critical piece of evidence in this case as the only physical evidence on Jasmine Miller.
Okay.
And if the court has nothing further, I will conclude my argument at that time.
Seeing no more questions, I want to thank you both for your arguments. The case was very well presented and we appreciate that. We will take the matter under advisement and issue our decision within the statutory 90-day period. That concludes this hearing and we will recess to await the next oral argument. Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.